Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We hope you enjoy today's show about technology ventures. We are very privileged to have as our guest Mr. Rick Clough, partner at Google Ventures Startup Lab. He will take us on a very exciting tour of how entrepreneurs can raise capital at Google Ventures, why Google Ventures is a unique venture firm, and the role of the Startup Lab in ensuring the success of all Google Ventures portfolio companies. Before joining Google, Mr. Rick Clough, who is also an entrepreneur, worked at FeedBurner, which was acquired by Google. He will tell us why he joined FeedBurner, and he will describe the great product that FeedBurner developed, which Google found extremely fantastic. Mr. Clough has also worked on the technology side of President Obama's political campaigns. In the last part of today's interview, he will discuss how political campaigns have changed over the past decade and how they might change in the future. We would like to thank Mr. Rick Clough very much for his time and for this interview, and we hope you enjoy today's show, and we wish all the entrepreneurs who are listening today all the very best of luck. Throughout today's show, we will listen to music by Chris Forsythe. First, we'll find out about Google Ventures and why they're different from any other venture capital firm, how much they're planning to invest this year, and how big their portfolio is.
Google Ventures is a venture capital firm. We are, in many ways, very similar to other venture capital firms here in Silicon Valley. And there's a couple of things that make us different. Our sole limited partner is Google. We invest up to $300 million a year in companies across a number of different sectors, where we think we can help them grow, and we're excited and eager to see them succeed. Our managing partner is Bill Maris, and he reminds us frequently, we are in an extraordinary position to help hundreds of companies succeed. It's really a unique opportunity within a company like Google that has been very fortunate. We see our role at Google Ventures as taking what we've been able to do at Google and try and extend that to many, many other companies. Today, our portfolio is over 150 companies around the United States, and we expect that to grow over the next couple of years.
When did Google Ventures start, and how much have they grown since then?
Google Ventures started in 2009. The fund was originally started as a fund investing about $100 million a year. We have increased the size of that fund a couple of times over the last few years, and as I mentioned, we now invest up to $300 million a year in companies of a number of different sectors.
What type of industries does Google Ventures invest in?
We've invested in a couple of primary categories, some that you would expect from a company like Google. Consumer internet, mobile are certainly two sectors where we've invested quite a bit. But then other areas of growth that we're very involved in are areas you wouldn't necessarily expect out of a company like Google. We invest in life sciences, clean tech, renewable energy, commerce certainly would be another one you would expect to see us involved in.
And what kind of companies or ideas attract Google Ventures?
Companies really trying to change the world, trying to do something significant and dramatic. And we want to invest in them, not only the capital that we put into them, but try and find ways that we can help them succeed in other ways that aren't necessarily related just to the money that you put in, whether that's experience or expertise that we can share, best practices, et cetera, are ways that we want to help them succeed.
How can listeners find out more about Google Ventures? And if there's an entrepreneur listening today and would like to contact Google Ventures, what is the best way to contact them?
Certainly go to googleventures.com. We list there not only the areas that we're involved in, the companies that have chosen to work with us, a little bit about each of us, who we are, and what we did prior to coming to Google Ventures. We also encourage folks to reach out. I'm very findable online, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's through my blog and Google+. I think it's pretty easy to find me online. We always recommend, though, that it's much better to be referred by someone we know, somebody who we've worked with, whether it's an entrepreneur, another investor, a colleague at Google, which helps us understand a little bit about who the entrepreneur is that's coming to us, right? The difference between a cold call and an actual warm referral can make a big difference. And that's one of the many benefits of being at a university like Stanford, is that Stanford's own network is quite extensive and often offers a number of different ways of getting in touch with us.
So if any of the entrepreneurs who are listening today would like to contact Google Ventures, what can we tell them about Google Ventures to help them prepare their business plan and their whole presentation?
Google Ventures is a radically different firm in the sense that not only is the makeup of our staff significantly focused on the non-investing portion of the team, and for every one person on the investing team, I think we've got five or six who work in other areas of the firm. We're different in the kinds of companies we look to invest in. We look for quirky, unique founders who are looking to make bold steps, change the world sorts of things. We're not looking for companies that are doing things that have been done before. But as a firm, I think we're very different in a couple of ways. We have a number of teams at Google Ventures comprised largely of former founders, entrepreneurs from a number of different startups who've also been very successful at Google. And we came together largely looking for ways to build out the things we wished we'd had when we were entrepreneurs. And then we work hard to give as many of those things to the entrepreneurs we invest in. So whether that's our design team, who are former designers on some of the largest products Google has shipped, to the recruiting team who helped hire thousands of engineers at Google, product managers like myself, who ran some of the largest products at Google, we look to make those resources available as the companies build themselves out, and then work with our colleagues on the marketing and communications team to help them on everything from launch communications to PR to communication strategies. Really an extraordinary collection of resources that I think are rare among investors and tremendously valuable to the companies we invest in.
Have any companies that Google Ventures invested in reached the IPO stage yet?
We've had a number of exits. We are still a young firm. We've been around now 3.5, will be 4 years later this year. We've had several exits in our early history. Just last year, we had companies that were bought by Twitter, Yahoo, Google. We've had a couple of IPOs earlier in our portfolio's history and remain very excited about the trajectory our companies are on today.
Does Google Ventures have a formula that they apply when they select companies to invest in?
There's no formula. I think if there was a formula for determining which companies would succeed, I think the world of venture capital as a whole would be quite a bit more predictable. And it's not. I think you look for a number of different things. I know when I'm sitting in on a pitch meeting, when an entrepreneur or team is coming in to pitch us, first and foremost, you look for a team. You want to know that the founders, the early team around that group of founders, knows each other, works well together, ideally has a history together in some way, whether they worked as part of a team at another company, they founded a company previously. I think those are always very good signs of a team with past success, both personally and professionally, certainly has much greater likelihood of success in the future. The product is also clearly important, but is likely to change at least a couple of times in the company's trajectory. So you try to avoid making too many decisions where you're evaluating specifically, will this product be a success? Will this application, will this app, this device? Because it's quite likely that that team will have to react to market conditions, information that they get back from their early customers. So you want to see those dynamics in total. And some succeed, some don't. That's the nature of the business that we're in.
I was very curious about the word quirky and what it meant for an entrepreneur to be quirky about their ideas.
When we talk about quirky, I think it's more that you've got an individual who is certain that they see an opportunity that others don't, that they refuse to listen to others saying that's not going to work, that's not going to happen. There's a certain amount of stubbornness that's inherent in that. Generally, they have a unique way of looking at things. They see opportunity where others see frustration or challenge or possibilities.
So how does Google Ventures select its entrepreneurs who are supposed to be quirky, stubborn, and dedicated to their ideas, and then guide them through experiments, testing, and workshops at Google Ventures Startup Lab so that they can be more successful?
So you mentioned Startup Lab, which is what I'm responsible for at Google Ventures. I'll talk a little bit about what Startup Lab is, and then I think I have a perfect example of that very issue. So Startup Lab is a collection of programs. I was asked about 18 months ago to come in, build this idea out, where my responsibility is to find all the expertise and experience across Google and, to the best of my abilities, make it available to the companies we've invested in. That's not necessarily the recipe for success. A lot of times it's the mistakes that were made. As Bill often says, if you're going to make mistakes, make new ones. Let us tell you the mistakes that we made when we were building out, in my case, Blogger, or part of the team that built out Google Plus or YouTube. We've got other people who worked on Gmail and Google Docs and a number of different products at Google. But it's also about best practices, things that we wished we'd known when we were in startups that, thanks to our experience at Google, we can help make available. So in a lot of ways, what the Startup Lab represents is an opportunity to transfer knowledge, best practices, and experience into the minds of entrepreneurs who are very eager to succeed, sometimes don't know what they don't know, sometimes have past experience that they want to build on, but are looking to be exposed to knowledge and wisdom that is beyond what they were able to experience themselves. So a perfect example, you asked, how can you take somebody who's stubbornly committed to building out something and then told that maybe their original idea isn't quite right, or the information from the users is telling them they need to go in a different direction. One of the workshops that we gave last year was a buddy of mine, a guy named Scott Johnston, who I consider to be one of the best product managers at Google. I asked him to come in and talk about what it meant to be a product manager, how to build a product team, how to think about product management in the context of the organization as a whole. And he had a great lesson that resonated with a number of people that were in the audience, because I've heard them talk to me about that issue in the months since, where he said, I persistently go into discussions about my product, certain that I am right, but looking for evidence that I'm wrong. And when I see that evidence and can appreciate that the evidence is convincing, I change my mind. So it's not that I was wrong when I had the original conviction, but the evidence helped me see that there was a different way around the problem or a different feature that needed to be built. He quoted now Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer about something she was famous for saying at Google, which was, if we've got data, let's go with data. If we're going to go with opinions, we'll go with mine. So there's a sense there that stubborn is good when you have conviction, but when there's data that tells you differently, you should listen to the data and make sure you have the people and processes around you that the data can help you see it when it's there.
How long does it take for Google Ventures to decide whether or not they're going to invest in a company?
The process of working with us, it's ideally a fairly quick one, at least in the initial stages, where companies either reach out to us or are introduced, as I mentioned, by someone we know we've worked with in the past. We try and give a quick look at what the company's doing, what they're focused on, and figure out whether it's an area where we can be helpful. There are companies that are going to go on to do great things that we either don't know that market sector very well, we don't feel like we know the user base for that particular product very well, and don't feel like we'd necessarily add a lot of value. We try and tell those entrepreneurs, we just don't think we're the right investor to help you succeed. Investing is about a lot more than just the check that you write. It's about all the help that comes afterwards. So assuming that it's a company that's in a space that we're engaged in, we feel we have unique value to add, then likely they'll come in and meet with our investing team, right? I'm not on the investing team. I'm on what we call the operations side, where I work with the companies we've already invested in. And over the course of what may be a couple of days, a couple of weeks, there's a back and forth where, as much as anything, those entrepreneurs are trying to determine whether we are a good match for them. This is not a monologue where they're either trying to convince us to write a check or we're trying to convince them to let us invest. It's much more of a dialogue. The point at which we choose to invest, there may be a discussion, there may be other investors that are involved in that round. And then once a company's in the portfolio, once we've invested, they're in the portfolio until they succeed. This is not an incubator where they're in for 12 weeks and then they're out. Once a company's in our portfolio, they're part of the family. And that's really where I come in, and others on the teams at Google Ventures, where our commitment at that point is to leverage as much of our experience, whether it be design, recruiting, marketing and communications, Startup Lab, which is what I'm responsible for, to help provide whatever information, wisdom, experience that we can to help that company succeed. If they need the help, they'll ask us for it. If they don't, and they're doing just fine on their own, then we'll talk to them when they have a need.
Thank you so much for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. This is Modern Tech News, and our show today is about technology ventures. Our guest, Mr. Rick Clow, is partner in Google Ventures Startup Lab. And if there are any Stanford entrepreneurs listening today, their startup could be very small. It could be 4 or 5 people at the most. Does Google Ventures provide seed capital?
One of the things that makes Google Ventures rare, not unique, but rare, is that we will invest very early in a company's existence, where it might be a team of 2 founders, 4 founders, with little more than a prototype, some wireframes, an idea, who are looking for seed funding to help them build out that initial prototype to test whether or not the idea really works. And we will invest all the way through to very late stage investments, where a company might be prepping for an IPO, might be preparing to expand internationally and needs capital to build out the international teams to complement what they're doing domestically. It's somewhat unusual for investors like us to be engaged across the spectrum of rounds that entails. But certainly, on a numbers basis, we invest in dozens of companies that are small and very, very early stage.
Is it true that some of Google Ventures' portfolio companies can rent space at Startup Lab?
At the Startup Lab, we have desks where companies have historically used for early office space. We found that while that's helpful to some of the companies, to be honest, space is not always the biggest need that they have and not the best use of my time or our time. Those desks remain available if companies need them. We find companies that aren't based in the Bay Area sometimes just need a place to put a briefcase in between meetings when they're in the Valley. And we certainly make that available at the Startup Lab. But we focus much more in that building on the workshops, the learnings, the mentoring, coaching that goes on, because that's a more scalable use of the space where we can reach more of our portfolio on a weekly basis.
Is it accurate to say that Google Ventures Startup Lab is like a small university?
You know, it's funny you ask. Startup Lab, when I first joined Google Ventures, was actually called Startup University. We had this notion that we wanted to convey the sense that this was where you went to learn how to grow a company, how to become successful. We found that that was a little confusing for folks who thought it was actually a school where there was a full curriculum and there were professors, and that was not at all our intent. This was much more ad hoc in terms of the lessons that were being offered or the opportunities to learn. So we changed the name fairly early on from Startup University to Startup Lab in an attempt to keep the focus very much on experimenting, learning, applying what you've learned in the past to experiments that you're doing in the future. But it's not a formal university in the sense that we would think of Stanford, for instance.
How does Startup Lab organize its workshops and select subject matters that interest and benefit the companies that are in Google Ventures portfolio?
Last year, we did about 36 events at the Startup Lab. My guess this year is we'll do somewhere 50 to 60, maybe more, depending on how quickly the portfolio grows. The content that is offered in the Startup Lab is really a blend of things I wished I'd had when I was at startups. Most recently, I was at a company called FeedBurner that was acquired by Google in 2007. I had worked at a number of startups prior to that. It's also increasingly what the startups are asking for. The more they are exposed to what we're able to teach them and convey, the more it occurs to them that there are opportunities to say, hey, I'd really like help with A/B testing. I've heard it's important. I've heard I should be doing it. I don't quite understand how to do it, or I don't understand how I would learn from an A/B test what I'm supposed to do differently. So, okay, we bring in Dan Soroker, who's actually a Stanford alum, who used to work at Google and then went to work on the Obama campaign and now has founded a company called Optimizely, which we have invested in, that makes A/B testing not only easy, but very actionable for a startup. So Dan comes in and leads the workshop on here's what A/B testing means, here's how to do it, here's how to learn from it, and here's how to make sure that you make it part of your formal process. So it's really a combination. I think something that's fairly common is we will offer one workshop, and then out of that workshop will come 3 more ideas for, boy, this was great, but I'd also like to hear about that other thing they talked about and mentioned in passing. Can we focus on that?
So what is A/B testing, and how can companies benefit from it?
A-B testing is a very simple concept in principle. It's something that used to be very difficult to do in practice. A-B testing is showing choice A to one group of people and choice B to another group of people, and then measuring whatever it is you wanted that group to do. Let's assume that at Stanford I have a performer coming to campus, not quite sure how best to convey who this person is or what they've done. Let's assume it's not a known performer. So I might, on one set of posters, describe the kind of music that they sing. And on another set of posters, I would show a photo of the performer and snippets of reviews by music critics. I might have different URLs on those posters. One address says to go to stanford.edu/performers/performer name, and the other one might be just coming up soon. I would measure the traffic to those two and figure out which one drove more actual attention, more conversion. And based on that test, I would be able to see, well, clearly the name of the performer and describing the music is more compelling. It's changing the words on a button. Do I get more people to click on the button if it says download or free trial? And once I've shown those two buttons to enough people and I can see which one got clicked on more often, I know which button words I'm supposed to use. So that's something that's fully part of the DNA at Google in terms of how we think about product design. You don't go with intuition, you go with data. Let the users tell you which presentation of content, which color, which formatting, how many links on a page. Do you use images? If so, how big should they be? All of those things are measurable, and A-B testing makes it very easy to get data about which experiment will convert higher. So that was one example of a workshop where we had talked about product management. Scott Johnston, in his workshop, had talked about the importance of experimenting. One of the people in the audience said, you know, you talked about experimenting. I just don't know how we would do that easily. We don't have enough engineers. We don't have enough bandwidth. And I said, well, you should talk to Dan Soroker. This is what they do. They're a portfolio company to boot. Asked Dan to come in. He was more than happy to do so and then led a workshop specifically on that subject.
Thank you for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. And now it's time for our first PSA. The B612 Foundation is a nonprofit organization that aims to build, launch, and operate the first privately funded deep space mission, a space telescope to be placed in orbit around the sun. The telescope will be used to map our inner solar system to better track the trajectories of Earth-crossing asteroids. The goal is to reduce the risk of a catastrophic collision. If you'd like to learn more or to contribute to this effort, visit them at b612foundation.org. That's b612foundation.org. Thank you for joining us today on our show about technology ventures. Our guest, Mr. Rick Clough, is partner in Google Venture Startup Lab. I asked Mr. Clough if any of the workshops given at Startup Lab were available online for the public.
The workshops that we have offered to date have been available only to the portfolio. The early thinking here was that this collection of content, knowledge, experience really is an asset that we're trying to invest in these companies. And one way to think of it is that one part of our investment was the check that we wrote, but a very significant portion of our investment in these companies is the knowledge and expertise that we invest in them. That said, it's clear that unless entrepreneurs, other investors can see what it is we do at the Startup Lab, it's hard to necessarily appreciate just how valuable it really is. So we know, based on feedback from our founders, from the employees at these companies, that it's tremendously useful to them. My hope is that over the next month or so, we're going to start making at least some of these workshops available to the public and keep them there. It's a way of giving a little bit back to the community, but also helping people understand just what it is that we do at the Startup Lab and appreciate just how useful that would be if you were at a startup and realizing this is a great example of the kind of value Google Ventures brings to a startup like mine.
Earlier, we found out that A/B testing was an example of the workshops that were given by Google Venture Startup Lab to the portfolio companies. I wanted to know if the Startup Lab also gave workshops on different kinds of computer languages.
I think languages specifically are a difficult one, in part because so much of the decision around what language to write in or what infrastructure to pick, which database to use, if you use a database at all. So many of those choices are manifestations of the kind of product you're trying to build, end up being fairly particular to that company, maybe to that product opportunity, and would be hard to create, if you will, a generic workshop that was applicable to more than just a handful of the companies. A lot of what I focus on within the Startup Lab is what can I do that is scalable that will impact a majority of the portfolio, if not all of the portfolio. So where I look for content, when I look for topics and leaders to lead those topics, it's really to try and find the things that are both uniquely trading on the wisdom that Google has developed over the years and is applicable to as many of the companies as possible. Generally speaking, I think languages in specific or, again, architecture end up being more of a one-on-one conversation than a broader workshop-type conversation.
How can people find out more about Google Ventures Startup Lab?
Google Ventures is at googleventures.com. And the Startup Lab specifically is at startuplab.googleventures.com. We are not only very good about updating the website regularly when we have new content to share, whether that be blog posts, videos, and so on. We're also very active on social media. So Twitter and Google Plus and Facebook all have Google Ventures pages. We're very good about not only talking about our portfolio and what they're up to, what new launches they've got, but if we've got any news about ourselves, we also make sure that it's there.
As you heard throughout today's show, Google Venture Startup Lab has a role in creating workshops and content to make Google's portfolio companies more successful. My next question was, what are the two or three areas which most entrepreneurial companies need help with?
There's a couple of areas that I think apply to any company in any sector where we can certainly, I hope, offer some help. One is basic execution, operations. How do you grow a team? The team you were at 5 people is not the team you can be at 25 or 50 or 100 or certainly 500 or more. What does it mean to manage a meeting, right? One of the workshops I led last year was on objectives and key results. Google, for almost its entire history, has managed its own objectives on a quarterly basis using a model that was introduced to Google by John Doerr, who's the legendary venture capitalist at Kleiner Perkins, who brought the concept from Intel. And objectives and key results really are pretty critical to how Google has managed its own growth from when it was about a year old to today. I led a workshop last fall on how we do it at Google and how our companies should think about, not they have to, right? If they have a model that's working well for themselves, then by no means are we going to tell them they need to do it differently. But it's an area that most companies feel they don't have expertise in. So operations execution are certainly an area where we try and offer a lot of guidance. Another is specifically around the team, hiring. How do you interview engineers? Not just show me some code on a whiteboard, but how do you calibrate feedback when you have multiple interviewers? What the CEO saw in a candidate is different than what the CTO saw, is different than what the VP of Business Development saw. How do you make sure that when you get that feedback from across the company, that you can calibrate it in a way that is useful to the company? What kinds of questions can you ask? Should you ask? What kinds of questions should you never ask? Are things that certainly as Google has grown, we've evolved our thinking on those things, and we're happy to share. Then I think there's a whole host of other areas, marketing, communications. We've done workshops on how to talk to the press. You know, somebody who's fresh out of school, has a great product idea, maybe has never talked to a journalist, doesn't know how to interpret the questions that he or she's being asked, and how to make sure that the answers you give don't lead you down a path you don't want to go down. Most journalists are not out to get you, but if you start answering questions in a way that suggests more interesting questions to ask, you might suddenly get well off the topic of something that's valuable to your company and create headlines or coverage of your company that's not conducive. So understanding that relationship is important. Managing your social media presence as a company was another one we gave. And then a whole host of other topics on product management, on engineering specifically. But those are a few that I think are applicable across the spectrum. And we had some of our life sciences companies sitting alongside some of our mobile app developers, sitting alongside some of the clean tech companies. So it clearly has broad applicability.
So if any Stanford entrepreneurs are listening today, add a page to their business plan that says quarterly objectives and key results. Would that help make Google Ventures invest in them?
Well, certainly that'll be a tip that they've been thinking about how to grow their company. And you know, we laugh, but so often you see an entrepreneur who starts the startup because there's a problem they want to solve. What you often miss is that there are entrepreneurs who are equally committed to the actual operation of a company. That's rare. But when you do see an entrepreneur who's thinking ahead about what is this company going to look like when it's 50 people, when it's 100 people, when it's 1,000 people, I mean, that's, go back to our early comment, that's a little quirky. That is a rare thing that you see. And when you see that, that's somebody that is thinking about the long term and not just thinking about, I'm going to have my fingers on the keyboard coding all day long. The most successful founders are the ones who really saw this as a significant investment of time and energy and understood that it was as much the function of the company as it was the product itself that was going to be the thing that made the difference.
Is there a magic number as to how many pages should be in a business plan?
No, there's no magic number to how many pages a business plan should be. I think those sorts of things, I think you can wrap yourself around the axle pretty quickly trying to make it just right. More often than not, I described it as a conversation. It really is. There's nothing more valuable at that stage. Boy, if you had a URL, if this were a web app or a mobile app, that's much more valuable than a business plan. But certainly an overview document does not have to be that in-depth. And I'm assuming here an earlier stage company. A later stage company that's got revenues and customers probably need to see a little bit of formality around that or else there might be some concern. But no, I think informal is not a bad thing, particularly early stage.
Our guest, Mr. Rick Lau, who is partner in Google Venture Startup Lab, is an entrepreneur in his own right. He was at FeedBurner before it was acquired by Google. So my next question was, how big was FeedBurner's business plan?
How big was the business plan for FeedBurner? This is an absolutely true story. As Google was completing the acquisition of FeedBurner, I was not a founder at FeedBurner. I was employee number 2 or 3 after the founders. We looked at the cocktail napkin from the lunch that the founders had had when they first conceived of what FeedBurner might become. And this is exceedingly rare for a startup. What was on that cocktail napkin was what Google bought. And I say it's rare because I mentioned earlier, it is quite common for teams as they learn, right? They get a prototype out, they get a beta out, they start to see what their users are doing. They see certain things that are unexpected and they start to maybe not pivot, but adjust. We didn't ever pivot at FeedBurner. What we grew over the 3.5, almost 4 years that that company was in existence, we executed on that original vision. And that's the company that got sold to Google in 2007.
When did FeedBurner start and what convinced Mr. Rick Lau to join FeedBurner?
FeedBurner started in 2004. I joined at the beginning of 2005, and the company was acquired in June of 2007. I made the decision to join FeedBurner. I'd met with a couple of the founders. It was rare at the time for there to be internet startups in Chicago, where we were based. I was living at the time. This group of four founders had founded and sold two companies prior to FeedBurner. This was their third company in a row. And when you find a founding team that has that degree of past success and such a clear vision of what it was they were trying to build, I'd had enough experience with startups to know that you can never perfectly predict what will succeed or not. But it certainly felt like there was a very high likelihood that this would be the team and the opportunity that would be successful.
So what was FeedBurner's line of business and how could a small startup like FeedBurner convince a big company like Google that they were a terrific investment and make Google want to buy them?
FeedBurner was a company that managed RSS content. RSS is really simple syndication. It's a way to, originally was created to manage the distribution of news content and evolved to also be a way for blogs to facilitate subscription so that people could follow along, whether it was a blog or a news site, in products like Google Reader is a popular one today. There were some client-side apps like NewsGator, NetNewsWire, and a few others back in the day. It also became the technology that made podcasts possible then and still today. The central concept behind FeedBurner was publishers were sending this content out, but unlike other web content, it was not measurable. They could not determine how many people had subscribed to the content. There were some limitations in the way that the technology worked that just made it impossible to know, was there one person subscribing to the content or 1,000 or 1,000,000? The goal of FeedBurner was to help publishers know what the size of the audience was, what the engagement with that content was, were people actually reading that content? And then once we were able to assess the size of that audience for those individual publishers, the goal was then to monetize that content and actually let publishers capture some value from this content channel they had built out. We built that out over the course of the 3 years that I was there. One of the things that was interesting to Google was that Google had tried to do the last piece, the ad network, in RSS content. They announced it, I think, 8 days after I joined FeedBurner, and I thought it might be the shortest startup tenure of anyone ever. But where Google found challenges, we succeeded. Ultimately, Google shut down its own effort in that area because they discovered things about that medium that were inherently very difficult to do that we had already solved. And we built up a network of publishers and advertisers who were actively engaged in that medium. And when FeedBurner was at a juncture where it would have either needed to raise additional capital as we were continuing to grow the business or potentially sell. And the offer from Google was right. And it was a tremendous outcome certainly for the employees and investors at FeedBurner. And I think it turned out pretty well for Google as well.
Thank you for joining us today on our show about technology ventures. I next asked our guest, Mr. Rick Lau, who is partner in Google Ventures Startup Lab, about how can a group of entrepreneurs decide which idea to present to Google Ventures first? Many entrepreneurs have more than one good idea. So is there a process that can help them decide which idea is the best idea to present first?
I don't know that there's a right answer to that question. I think of a good friend of mine who used to work with me at Google and then became an entrepreneur in residence at Google Ventures and then eventually started his own company called FireSpider Labs. His name is Craig Walker. He was the founder of a company called Grand Central that became Google Voice. What he started after he left Google Ventures was more of an incubator of a bunch of ideas than a single company. FireSpider Labs is the name of that company, and they've really got three successful products. I think in Craig's case, that was doable in part because of who he is, right? He's been tremendously successful. He's an incredibly smart guy. And it was clear that he had the ability to find the teams that would help him execute on a number of those ideas. That said, focus is a very, very good thing. Successful entrepreneurs generally say no more than they say yes. Fewer features are often a better path than we'll add it because somebody asked for it. So I think if I were starting something tomorrow and I had three ideas, deciding which one I'd want to pitch to Google Ventures or another investor, I think I'd want to very quickly assess which one seemed to have the most potential. And there are a couple of fairly clever ways you can test that potential. You might start advertising. Open up an AdWords account and describe the product you haven't built yet and describe the three products you think might be interesting. See which one drives the most interest. Do people sign up? Do people get on the wait list for this product when it's released? I've seen a number of entrepreneurs do that and use that as a proxy for what would be interest in a product. And then, okay, let's throw our energy into actually building that. You might do a quick prototype, even if it's just mocking it up in Keynote or PowerPoint or a web app that doesn't actually have all the functionality behind it. I love the story. Alexis Ohanian is the co-founder of Reddit. He tells a great story about how they faked Reddit for months. They had hundreds of fake accounts to create the appearance of the site they wanted it to be. And then as they started seeing actual users mimic the behavior that they had been faking, inventing, that was when they knew they were onto something. I think those ways of assessing which is the idea with the most potential, generally want to lead with that one. But there are examples, as I said with Craig, where multiple ideas is not necessarily the wrong answer. But I think you want to have a track record of having proven that you can do that, as Craig did, before that's the approach that you take.
My next question was, how can a group of entrepreneurs who don't have much capital even begin to think that their idea can become big enough to attract a large company like Google? Most people think that big companies, whether it's Google or Facebook, can do anything that they want in-house. So how can small companies who don't have any resources compete with that?
One of the biggest opportunities for companies like Google is the scale at which it operates makes a lot of things possible. When I was running the homepage at YouTube, there is something addictive, truly addictive, about knowing that decisions you're making affect 500 million people a week, a month, who are coming to that site to watch videos. By the same token, that scale is also a challenge, by which I mean not the infrastructure needed to support the scale. That's, of course, a challenge. But the challenge I'm talking about is sometimes ideas are too small for a large company to pursue. It's notable that Instagram, Yahoo had Flickr, which did photo sharing. Facebook had Photos that did photo sharing. Google has Picasa that does photo sharing. Google Plus existed when Instagram was growing and does photo sharing. And yet Instagram built out this incredibly fast-growing, feature-limited product that did something that really at some level was too small for any of the other photo players in the space to really worry about. They were thinking bigger things about bigger challenges that photo sharing entailed. And they came out of nowhere, and it was too small for any of the big players to worry about until it was too big. And I think that's the kernel of where any startup has a real opportunity, is that a team of five can afford to chase a small thing until it turns into something big. And that conviction we talked about early on, where the founder who just stubbornly persists thinking this is big, that's the sort of thing that a small team can afford that focus. They're not distracted. They don't have 19 other teams they have to coordinate with to think about, we're going to build this feature out, but oh, there's two other teams on another project that are building something similar, and you really can't do that. Startups don't have any of those concerns. So sometimes scale works against some of the bigger companies, and I think there's tremendous opportunity for smaller companies to get the kernel of an idea and then test it, tweak it, pursue it until they hit on the big idea. And then they're the entrenched, established player. And the other guys look at it and say, well, boy, I didn't see that coming. And now we have to figure out, is this something that we can build ourselves? Or is the better answer to acquire the small guy? Because we want a team like that to come in and help us think differently about the opportunities we're chasing.
Thank you for joining us today on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. And now it's time for our next PSA. Kickstart is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to lift millions of people in Africa out of poverty quickly, cost-effectively, and sustainably. Co-founded by Stanford alumnus Dr. Martin Fisher, Kickstart designs, promotes, and markets simple money-making tools that small farmers buy and use to start profitable family enterprises. You can help families permanently change their lives by contributing to Kickstart. For more information, visit kickstart.org. Our guest, Mr. Rick Clow, who is partner in Google Ventures Startup Lab, has worked on several important political campaigns over the past 10 years, including President Obama's Senate campaign in 2004 and both President Obama's presidential campaigns. I was curious how technology has influenced political campaigns over the past 10 years and how technology might change campaigning over the next few years.
So we're beginning of 2013. 10 years ago, right about now, actually, the Dean campaign was ending. Forget when the Iowa caucus was. I think it was January of 2003. I'd been involved in the Dean campaign for a little over a year at that point. I had read an article in The Economist in the summer of 2002. It was about a little-known Vermont governor who was saying a lot of things that were very interesting to me, particularly on civil liberties. I wanted to get involved. So I called Burlington. Howard Dean had no website for either his governor's office or his campaign. So I had to call directory assistance, which seems quaint now a decade later, but I did. And I got a woman who turns out was a part-time employee of the presidential campaign, the only employee of the presidential campaign at the time. And I told her, I said, you know, it seems to me that you have a candidate saying a lot of the right things, but no opportunity. You're not raising money. You're just not going to have the same potential that the rumored front runners at the time were going to be John Kerry. There were rumors of Hillary Clinton at the time, but it was too early for her, Dick Gephardt, and a couple of others. And I said, you know, I've been involved with these blogs for a couple of years, and it seems like it's a free, easy way to get known. So I said, look, here's my name, here's my number. If you need help, call me. And about 3 months later, the phone rang. And it was a full-time staffer. And he said, you know, we're going to need help with technology. Is that something you can do? Long story short, I ended up getting very involved with the tech team. And that campaign became very known for pushing the boundaries of a lot of things that we take for granted today in how to use technology in the context of a campaign. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who was telling the Dean campaign, you should use blogs. There's lots of ways of leveraging technology to grow. But I'm very fortunate to have been in touch with everybody from Joe Trippi, who was the campaign manager, on down, in working very closely with that team over the next year. It was an exciting time. The campaign obviously didn't end the way at the time we wanted it to. After it ended, I went on to work for then State Senator Barack Obama, who was running for U.S. Senate in 2004. And I ended up running his campaign blog in 2004. He obviously did quite well that year. And then I stayed in touch with many of the folks on the tech team from the 2004 Senate race, who then became the genesis of his technology team in the 2008 presidential race. And then many of those same folks were also involved in 2012. To answer your question, how things changed. Certainly, you look back a decade ago, there was no YouTube, there was no Twitter. Blogs were barely known, certainly hardly used. And online fundraising was still a thing that was new and weird. Campaign fundraising back in the day was largely done through professional fundraisers and large campaign donors. There was no sense of average citizens feeling like they had a need or even an opportunity to be involved in campaigns. What I think a lot of technology has done most recently is give the campaigns, not so much the candidates as it is the campaigns, an opportunity to establish more of a conversation with the constituents, which I think is a very good thing. I remember for me, the aha moment was in that 2004 Senate race. I was running the campaign blog, and ahead of Senator Obama's speech at the convention, before anybody in the rest of the country really knew who he was, we did a kind of an open thread, just a one line. And some of the posts would be written under my name. Some of the posts were written under his name. And in this one, it was under his name. And it was simply, I'm speaking at the Democratic convention next month. What stories should I be telling? What do you want the rest of the country to know? Now, we should all know he was not fishing for lines to use in the speech. That was not what that was about. But it was an opportunity to give people in the state of Illinois a feeling like they were being heard. And some of the comments were so moving. I remember one, there was a Maytag plant downstate Illinois that had been closed. And one of the women who had worked at that plant left a comment on that post talking about the impact it had had in the community. They were the largest employer in that city. And you had people who had no health care. You had people who were losing pensions. You had just tremendous economic hurt. And not 3 days later, but that anecdote was in his stump speech in another part of the state. And you started to see this round trip of you say something on the blog, a citizen speaks up in the comments, and the candidate is now echoing those comments back out to the rest of the community. It was a really powerful early example of when it works well, it works really well. The less obvious things that are happening that I think were clearly at use, certainly in the most recent campaign, largely get grouped under the buzz term big data. What that's really talking about is using computers to crunch a lot of numbers. One of the things that the Obama campaign did very, very well in this race was if you had installed the campaign app in your Facebook account, the Obama campaign was able to see who your friends were, and if they had put their address information into Facebook, the campaign could match that data against the voter rolls. And throughout the election day, they were looking by precinct at where they needed more outreach, more turnout. And so throughout the day, I would be getting Facebook notifications, not to post to your wall and spam all your friends, but send a note to Heather, who lives outside of Tampa. Tell her she should get out to vote. Now, it wasn't that they knew that she had or hadn't voted, but that they knew she was in the county where turnout had been low. That kind of marrying of social data, voter data, turnout is extraordinary for what it means to really leverage technology in a way that ensures the system works. Now, I'm a partisan, right? The candidates I've supported historically have been Democrats. Most recently, in addition to advising the Obama campaign, I have a friend who ran for Congress in the East Bay who won. He was sworn in early January. He's a Democrat as well. But when I think about these kinds of things, for me, it's not about electing more Democrats. It's about that example of Facebook and the voter data. It's important that people vote. And the fact that the technology is making it easier for the campaigns to reach out. I want Republican candidates to do the same thing. I want more people to feel like they have a stake in the election. I want more people to actually participate in the process. And if we have more candidates talking to more constituents, we have more campaigns ensuring that people do, in fact, register to vote, turn out, and vote, the country at that point gets the elected officials that we deserve. And the more of us that are involved in the process, the better off we are.
So if it's addictive to work at YouTube or another internet company where one's decisions impact 500 million people who use the company's software every month or two, what's it like to work on a political campaign that can impact all the 7 billion people who live in the world today?
It's moving to work on a campaign, whether on a volunteer basis or full-time staffers. It's really something to behold when you see, there were hundreds of mostly young Americans who believe in the candidate that they're supporting. And I know this was equally true. I have friends who worked for Governor Romney, and it's equally true on the other side of the aisle. When you see that faith, when you see that commitment, it's tremendously uplifting. It's easy to get wrapped up in the horse race element of campaigns and lose sight of the fact that there are important issues that need to get debated. I went to law school, and though I've never practiced and never will, the thing I really loved about that experience was the fact that it's only by having two opposing opinions, right? You have the prosecution, you have the defense, that you get some sense of truth that comes out of that process. And only when both sides are equally equipped and capable does the system really do well. If you have an incompetent prosecutor, more defendants are going to get off. Some of them certainly shouldn't have gotten off. If you have an incompetent defense, government's going to run roughshod over defendants, and certainly some of them were wrongly accused. And I think the same is true of politics. If you have equally motivated supporters, equally motivated, capable campaigns, you get a better outcome. Certainly, running the homepage of YouTube while tremendously personally fulfilling and gratifying is nothing like thinking about the future of the country and trying to figure out what's the right path forward and what do I think about some of these issues. It's one of the reasons I remain involved in politics as a hobby. It's never been my profession. Don't expect it ever will be. But it's a way to feel connected to the process and feel like I have some stake in the outcome.
Before we finish this interview, I asked our guest, Mr. Rick Clough, who is partner in Google Ventures Startup Lab, for a brief summary about what the lucky entrepreneurs who are selected by Google Ventures are usually like, and if and how those entrepreneurs need to resonate with the investing team at Google Ventures.
We see entrepreneurs along a spectrum from third-time founder with two prior successful exits to about to graduate from Stanford. They've had this idea for 2 years and they can't get it out of their head and they need to do it. And it really is a spectrum and you've got others in between. Do the founders need to resonate? At some level, yes, there's a connection that needs to be made. You have to believe that this is the person or the team who can not only bring some brilliant insight into the making of the thing that they want to build, but that they are the team capable of motivating people to join them. You got to hire more people. The startup is not always only going to be these four people, two people, five people. Are they stubborn enough to stay on the path that they think is right while rational enough to listen to the data? Are they capable of living through the not great nights? Startup life is not easy. It just isn't. You want a team that can gut it out and deal with adversity because that adversity will come. You'll get the competitor that seems like they've got the right answer and they're going to come after you guns blazing, or you're going to lose the big customer, or you're going to have a bug that shows up on TechCrunch and you have to deal with the aftermath. All kinds of things go wrong along the path to it going right. And you want to know that the team can handle that and get through it and be stronger coming out the other end. So once we invest, the company's in the portfolio. And we are committed to their success. Now, that company may get to a point where it needs to raise more money. And sometimes we are an investor in that next round. Sometimes we aren't. We're an investor. We are committed to their success. And that's where all of these other teams at Google Ventures come into play, whether it's helping them design the product, helping them understand how to interpret the user research, the marketing and communications team, helping them understand how to tell the story. Right? It's one thing to have a great product. It's another one to be able to communicate to others who don't know it, haven't seen it before. Why is it great? Why does it matter? And then like the startup lab, helping them acquire this additional knowledge that I take for granted, having been at Google close to 6 years, I'm surrounded by extraordinary people. My job is to help try and surround these entrepreneurs with as much of that expertise as I can to increase the likelihood that they will be successful.
Thank you for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We hope you stay tuned for the show that's coming up at 1 p.m. It's the Sports Zoo with two of Stanford's best sports broadcasters, Sam Fisher and Dave Lombardi. They will have the latest sports news from Stanford and from around the Bay. After Sports Zoo, if you stay tuned to Sunshine in the Afternoon, you are in for a treat that will brighten up your day. So please join us today at 1 p.m. for the Sports Zoo and at 2 p.m. for Sunshine in the Afternoon.
So to KZSU Stanford listeners, thank you very much for taking the time to learn a little bit about what we're doing at Google Ventures. If you have an idea, chase it. This is an absolutely extraordinary time to be in the Valley, to be thinking about changing the world. Go ahead, make that commitment, chase the passion, and talk to us. Let us know what you're doing. We'd love to find more entrepreneurs who believe they're going to change the world. We want to be part of that conversation.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. We would also like to thank our guest, Mr. Rick Lau, partner in Google Ventures Startup Lab. If you would like additional information about Startup Lab, please visit their website, startuplab.googleventures.com. If you would like a copy of today's interview, please download it from our website, moderntechnews.com. That's moderntechnews.com.